Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Mark David Hall, the Herbert Hoover Distinguished Professor of Politics and Faculty Fellow in the William Penn Honors Program at George Fox University. He has written, edited, and co-edited 10 books, including Roger Sherman and the Creation of the American Republic, and most recently, Faith and the Founders of the American Republic, which he co-produced with a frequent collaborator of his, Daniel Dreisbach, at American University. Regular listeners will know that Mark is the Will Smith of research on religion in that he comes back every year with a blockbuster episode during the week of July 4th. In the past, we have had him talking about his writings on Roger Sherman, the role of religion during the founding era more generally, and last year he was part of an interesting debate with two other scholars regarding whether or not Christians should have picked up arms during the American War of Independence. Mark took a firm position on the squishy middle, saying that, yeah, maybe, but they should have perhaps waited a little bit more. As usual, we will link to Professor Hall's books and those previous podcasts at our website, or you can search for those episodes in our extensive archives, now brimming with over 200 interviews, a true treasure trove of knowledge. Mark, welcome back once again to Research on Religion and our annual celebration of religion during the American Revolutionary Era.
Great to be back, Tony. Who's that in the studio with you?
Oh, those are the Barkington Elementary School Cheer Squad kids. We had them on an episode a few weeks ago, and they just loved coming in, and so we invited them for another field trip into the studio. So 25 kids here sitting in the background. They've increased my audience fivefold, so you got a big audience.
Fantastic.
Okay. So in the past, we've covered the role that religion played in the U.S. founding by discussing how religious thought of certain historical figures, namely Madison and Jefferson, played out in our nation's legal history. That was one of our first podcasts that we ever did, and it was great having you on then, started a tradition. In the following year, we discussed one of the lesser known but perhaps more important founders, Roger Sherman, Puritan patriot. And then last year we got all gunned up and talked about the religious ideas floating around at the time regarding whether or not the colonists should have violently seceded from Britain. Now, from my vantage point, that would seem to cover everything that anybody needs to know about religion in American history. So do you have anything more to say, or should we just talk about baseball for the next hour?
Well, I know next to nothing about baseball, so perhaps we should, in fact, talk about religion in the American founding.
Okay. Anything on your agenda right now?
Yeah, well, it just so happened that Oxford University Press recently published a book that my buddy Daniel Dreisbach and I edited called Faith and the Founders of the American Republic, and there's more than enough great information there to talk about for an hour at least.
Well, all right. You've done 10 books right now on the founding era, which is really interesting, and most of your books have that title in there, the founding era, and they also have very cool pictures. You have some of the best covers on any of your books because it has that stained glass, founding era look to all of them, and some of those great paintings from that era. But what motivated you more generally just to work on this era? You're a political scientist, and so, you know, political scientists deal with current events, but you're back a couple hundred years. What's going on there?
Yeah, there's really two things at play here. There's a very, very common narrative among both scholars and popular authors and jurists that goes something like this. The founders were deists who desired a strict separation of church and state. And I just think this is largely false. You know, I'd want to qualify it a bit more carefully, but for the purposes of our podcast, I'll just say it's basically false. And it's problematic for two reasons. First of all, I think it's important to get our founding era history right, just like any era of history, and it's historically inaccurate. But second of all, the second part of what I said, that the founders desired the strict separation of church and state, has made its way into America's jurisprudence, the Supreme Court jurisprudence, and it's had an impact on public policy, an impact that I think is very unhealthy. So Justice Stevens and others would use this high wall separation that supposedly exists to make it impossible to have vouchers go to private religious schools and things of that nature. So I think it's very important to disabuse scholars and jurists of this myth.
That was one of the things that we discussed in one of our very first podcasts on this series. And you made a very convincing argument, I think, about how the views of namely Madison and Jefferson, who are the two that tend to get cited all the time, have been represented or misrepresented by scholars throughout the years, especially in the past 50 years. You've been on this campaign, I think, to really kind of correct the record. Have you noticed other people, scholars, jurists, really starting to rethink the founding era in the last few years?
You know, I think there's definitely been a pretty big shift, both on the court and among scholars. So if you look at these books throughout a lot of the 20th century, even into the 21st century, that make this sort of argument that the founders were deists who wanted the strict separation of church and state, almost inevitably, they do the same thing. They focus in on five or six major founders, and they are certainly very important founders, but they also are pretty unrepresentative. So people like Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, and usually George Washington, and James Madison. And they look at these folks and they find private references and letters from Adams and Jefferson that show, in fact, they did clearly depart from Orthodox Christianity. Or Ben Franklin is a very young man. We have him on record as rejecting some of these things. And so they look real carefully at these five or six founders, and then they generalize from these five or six founders and say most of the founders or many of the founders shared these views. And similarly, with respect to church-state relations, they're particularly, a lot of these guys, like Adams and Washington, weren't particularly troubled by having the state support or endorse religion or even Christianity specifically. And so there you have a similar tale with a focus on Jefferson and Madison. And so what we've attempted to do, my friend Daniel Dreisbach and myself with Jeffrey Morrison for a few of these volumes, this is the Faith in the Founders of the American Republic is the third in a series of sort, where we've profiled something like 33 or so founders and then a few traditions as well. And what we're trying to do is expand the conversation. And we're saying, look, if you look at the broader constellation of American founders, including very important founders like Roger Sherman and Samuel Adams and John Jay and Patrick Henry, a very different picture begins to emerge. And in fact, when you look carefully at some of these founders like James Madison and George Washington, the evidence that they're heterodox Christians or deists, it really is pretty flimsy. So by expanding the conversation, I think we've made it far more difficult to say with a straight face that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Ben Franklin represent all the American founders, or that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison represent the founders on church and state.
And on one of our other previous podcasts, you made a really good case about the importance of Roger Sherman, who we oftentimes forget about. And I need to pause here a minute and note that in that interview on Roger Sherman, I had a very bad habit of calling that Puritan patriot Richard Sherman, who at that time had been recently recruited as a cornerback for the Seattle Seahawks. And I note this because, as many of you know, I'm a big football fan and have been a Richard Sherman fan long before he tipped that Colin Kaepernick pass to Michael Crabtree back in the 2014 NFC Championship game, and then went on to give probably one of the best post-game interviews in the history of professional sports. So I just want to note that I am on board the Richard Sherman train before it was cool to be on board the Richard Sherman train. And you've been on the Roger Sherman train long before it's been cool to be on the Roger Sherman train. And then I got this other question, though, because I am a Richard Sherman fan. Do you have any plans to write about Richard Sherman and the American founding?
Yeah, it so happens one of our PR guys here, George Fox, said, "Hey, Hall, why don't you write something on Richard Sherman so someone will actually read what you write, and we'll get some good publicity." And so we floated the idea to Slate, but believe it or not, they weren't interested. The similarity between Richard Sherman and Roger Sherman just wasn't compelling for them.
I know, but Richard Sherman is compelling on everything. I should try to get him on the show at some time. Religion and Richard Sherman, because he's so cool. Anyways, okay, so no Roger or Richard Sherman today. What I'm interested, though, it happens to be some of the stuff that's really fascinating in your new book, which is the role of religious minorities in the American founding. Now, lots of people can talk about the Congregationalist or the Anglicans / Episcopalians, but your volume actually starts to document the role that folks like Jews and Quakers played, which is really interesting. So let's go ahead and jump into that topic, shall we?
Sure, that'd be great.
Let's start out with a really little-known facet of the American founding, and this you had invited somebody to write about this, and that's Jews and the founding. You had David Dallin, I think, was the person who wrote this chapter. And to be honest, I didn't even know there were any Jews in America way back when. How many Jews were there in America during the founding era?
Well, scholars debate the number, but probably right around 2,000, largely in four or so cities, Philadelphia and Savannah and Newport and New York and Philadelphia, I think. So we have these little congregations or clusters of Jews in the American founding. They arrived actually pretty early in New Netherland. And had some problems sticking around, but the Dutch East India Company pretty much insisted on it because they liked having these immigrants come to America. And so they've been here from, close to the beginning. But by the time we get to the late 18th century, probably about 2,000 or so in these four or five American cities.
Okay, so they're still fairly concentrated. Now, New Netherlands eventually became New York as we know it, correct?
Right.
Yeah. Here's the big question. Being Jewish in European history has always been hit and miss. Sometimes they're tolerated, and we saw that in the case of the New Netherlands. They said, these folks are great merchants, don't bother them at all. But other times, man, the Jews are just hated and persecuted. How were they received in the American colonies over the 200 years or so leading up to the American Revolution?
Yeah, I'm pleased to say that the rule of thumb is that they were tolerated, and they certainly weren't persecuted. Now, they were discriminated against in certain respects. Many of the colonies had religious tests for office that would keep Jews from holding political office, but generally tolerated, allowed to exist, engage in commerce, worship freely, and this sort of thing.
How did they play a role in the founding? I mean, your book is about the role of faith in the American founding. There's only 2,000 of them, and they're scattered across four cities hither and yon. I mean, they can't have any potential influence at all, right?
Yeah, well, of course it was limited, but they did have some important influence. So David Dallin documents pretty well that, first of all, one of the things he does is show what different founders thought about the American Jews, and there were various views. But in the course of doing so, he mentions a couple of specific people. One, a fellow named Ames Solomon, actually ended up helping work with George Washington to finance the Continental Army, pulling resources out of thin air sometimes. And Washington clearly recognized the important role he played. There were several others as well, some of which I think we'll come to in a minute.
Yeah, go ahead and just document these. I know Washington had a pretty good relationship with a number of Jews, and he wrote a letter to some folks at a synagogue in Newport.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is one of my favorite letters from the American founding. So this congregation in Newport, a synagogue, sent him a letter after he had become president, congratulating him. And he wrote them a great letter back saying, basically, we speak no longer of toleration in America, but you're welcome here as long as you're good citizens, and we're thrilled you're here. And he goes on to quote, the last paragraph makes something like 8 allusions to the Hebrew Scriptures, including Micah 4:4, which is one of George Washington's favorite verses, just making it crystal clear that in America, everyone is welcome, that we aren't going to be discriminating on the basis of religion. And so Washington had a very positive view of Jews in America, and I think part of that at least comes from his good experiences in the war for independence.
Yeah, you mentioned something very interesting that just caught my ear. You said in his letter to the Newport Synagogue that Jews, it's not just toleration anymore. Was he alluding to the fact that religious liberty is even more important than toleration? Toleration, you just kind of get by, but liberty, you really get to flourish.
That's exactly right. Oh, I should quote the sentence since you're interested, and I just love it. He says, it is now no more that toleration is spoken of as if the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. So it's a distinction, a very important distinction there between toleration, which means you know, well, I'll put up with this, but I might change my mind, versus a natural right to liberty, a natural right to religious liberty that isn't something that the majority just decides to grant, but it's something that we all have a right to. And I think he's embracing this position that, look, in America, we're founded upon this this notion that all men should be able to worship God according to the dictates of the conscience, men and women, I should say.
And one of the cases that you made early on in one of our podcasts, the podcast specifically on Roger Sherman, was that colonial America was steeped in religious imagery and religious discussion, and just so focusing on Madison or Jefferson or something, it's not just enough, but you really need to figure out the religious background that is permeating there. And so people's early religious influences have an effect early on. Now, this is something that I hadn't even known about, but Alexander Hamilton had some early relations or influence with Jewish individuals. Is that true?
That's absolutely right. So, as you know, how Alexander Hamilton was born down in the Caribbean, and he was, and I'm sorry to use the word, but I will, he was a bastard. He was a product of an illegitimate union, and so as such, he couldn't attend the regular Anglican school. And so he ended up attending a small school run by Sephardic Jews, and he studied Hebrew as a young man, and throughout his life had a very, very positive view of Jews. There's even rumors or possibilities that one of his ancestors might have been at least part Jewish.
Hmm. And does that somehow come through and reflected in his thought at all? Or is this just he went to school there? I mean, I went to school in Wisconsin. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm a cheesehead.
Right. Yeah, I believe, if I recall the chapter correctly, that he was always, you know, to the extent to which he was able to play a role in these sorts of things, a great advocate of religious liberty. And I believe at Columbia, he made sure that there'd be room on the board of trustees, what was King's College, what became Columbia, for a Jewish rabbi to sit, as well as Protestant ministers. Back in this era, most members of a board of trustees would be ministers, and he wanted it to be a very inclusive body, as opposed to some of the other denominational schools, where maybe everyone would be a Congregationalist or Presbyterian who was on the board of trustees.
Yeah, and this is one of the interesting things I find about your research is that, you know, we oftentimes focus on very direct and blatant comments made by certain individuals throughout history, but it's these little things, that the little actions and types of thoughts that other individuals do that really add to the multi-layered fabric of American history, just as saying, hey, Columbia University, let somebody who's Jewish sit on the board. And that has a little influence on somebody else and on somebody else. And it's woven into the tapestry of American history, I think.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And there's another interesting Jewish connection that has to deal with John Adams. That one, again, fascinated me. What's the deal with Adams?
Yeah, Adams, like Washington and Hamilton, had a very positive view of the Jews in America. Certainly thought they should be respected, that their rights to worship God, according to the dictates of their conscience, should be respected. What's interesting about him is in some correspondence, he actually makes it crystal clear that he would like to see Israel form again as an independent country. So he's a Christian Zionist. Much like we saw the Zionist movement in the late 19th, early 20th century, eventually resulting in the nation-state of Israel. Adams is clearly on record saying this would be a good thing in the late 18th century.
Which is amazing, right? Because we think of the modern Zionist movement just dating back maybe 150 years ago, but it really digs much deeper than that, and it has its thumbprint in American history.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I knew nothing about this, so I really enjoyed this chapter.
Another figure that comes up in David Dallin's chapter on Jews in the American Founding was Thomas Jefferson. What's his take on Jews?
Yeah, well, Jefferson, of course, is famously an advocate for religious liberty, so there's no question that they should be free to worship God as they see fit. But Jefferson really was pretty much a bigot with respect to traditional religion. So he thought the Jewish religion was just ridiculously superstitious and that no one would be a serious Jew. And this isn't anti-Semitic at all. He thought the same thing about Calvinists, right? How could you be so irrational as to believe in predestination and such? Now, Calvinists, like Jews, should certainly be tolerated. They should be allowed to worship God. But with respect to the actual content of Orthodox Jewish belief or other forms of Orthodox religion, Christianity and otherwise, he just thought it was utterly ridiculous, utterly ignorant.
So all these folks we've been talking about, Hamilton, Adams, Jefferson, Washington, they've had their connections with different Jewish people during the founding. They've run across them or been influenced them in certain ways. But was there any direct connection between members of the Jewish faith and the construction of religious liberty in the United States? I've always thought that religious minorities have a big stake in religious liberty, and you know, it wouldn't be surprising that if Jews are only about 2,000 folks there, they would have a huge incentive to actually be speaking out for religious liberty. But on the other hand, we know in history that religious minorities are oftentimes very cautious about speaking out on political issues because they can easily be targeted. Was there any direct relationship between Jews and prompting the different documents of the American founding?
Yes, yes. One of my favorite actors in this era is a fellow named Jonas Phillips, a Jew in Philadelphia leader. And Philadelphia is in Pennsylvania, of course, and we think of Pennsylvania as this wonderfully tolerant Quaker colony and state, and it was fairly much. But even in Pennsylvania, you had a religious test for office. The Constitution of 1776 had a provision whereby basically you had to be a Trinitarian Christian in order to hold political office. You had to believe in the divine inspiration of the Old and the New Testament. And Jonas Phillips fought this. He fought in Pennsylvania, trying to get the Council of Vision to change this. And he famously sent a petition to the Constitutional Convention when it was meeting in 1787 in Philadelphia, and basically said, hey, America should be a place where Jews as well as Christians are able to hold political office. And so can you please, change this restriction on American Jews? I think he was a little confused about what exactly the Constitutional Convention was doing. But, of course, the Constitution that came out of Philadelphia prohibited religious tests for federal office. And then in Pennsylvania, I'm pleased to report, the Constitution of 1790 changed the religious test. Now, it's sort of interesting how they changed it. They changed it so that you only had to be a theist to hold office. So there still is a religious a test in place, but it's now one that can be met by Jews as well as Christians and other theists. So pretty much anyone in the American founding. There might have been a few closet atheists, but they certainly weren't going to admit it.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to another religious minority here, and that is the role of Islam or the role of Muslims. And one of the other chapters, it came as a big surprise to me, and that was The Founders and Islam, written by Tommy Kidd, who we also have had featured a couple times on this podcast. And I have to admit, I thought the topic of Islam would be a null set, since the closest Muslims to the American colonies were probably a half a globe away. So was this a short chapter, or was there something to say about Muslims in America?
Yeah, no, Tommy Kidd had great things to say. He's just a fine scholar. So one of the things he points out is that something like 200,000 slaves were taken from parts of Africa that had a pretty significant Islamic influence. And so we just simply don't know how many of them were Muslims. But we do know that some were Muslims. We have evidence that at least some were, and maybe even large numbers. Now, of course, they're ripped out of Africa, brought over to America, and then slave owners attempt to indoctrinate them and teach them English, and some would try to teach them about Christianity and such. And so there are some Muslims here. They certainly aren't American citizens, and they certainly aren't directly playing a role in debates about the new state constitution, so the federal constitution or the war for independence. But there are some physically here. And the idea of Islam or Muslims does pop up in various political debates.
How so?
Generally, it's a trope for purity. Islam or Turkey is viewed as ultimate in despotism, the sort of thing we have to avoid. And as well, oftentimes, particularly when the Constitution was being debated, some of the anti-federalists objected, how in the world can we have a Constitution that doesn't have a religious test for office? This could lead to an atheist or a Muslim getting elected to Congress. And both of those things are pretty much about the sort of most far-fetched, horrendous scenario one could imagine. There could just be nothing worse to imagine than a Muslim or an atheist being elected to political office, and so therefore the Anti-Federalists said, we should reject this proposed constitution, or, failing that, amend the constitution to prohibit these unacceptable groups from ever holding political office in America.
How much did those arguments resonate? I'm trying to put myself back in the historical period of time. You mentioned that a number of slaves would have been Muslims, but they're down south or in other places in the colonies. They're not a central part of the Constitutional Convention, but these tropes are coming up. Is the image of Turkey or of the Ottoman Empire and tyranny and Muslims really resonating in the American conscience, or is just one of many arguments that the Anti-Federalists and others made?
Yeah, that's a great sense. It's my sense that it wasn't really overly convincing. You know, it's just such a far-fetched idea, particularly with respect to Muslims, that, you know, it kind of makes sense that the Anti-Federalists would make those sort of arguments, but I don't think it's a real fear. I mean, I think almost everyone in the era, Federalist and Anti-Federalist, would say we don't want a Muslim to be in Congress, and we certainly don't want a Muslim to be president. But no one saw it really as a real possibility. And even the Anti-Federalists would say things like, well, you know, this is unlikely in the near future, but what about 100 years from now? You know, then it might be a possibility. And so therefore we should reject this proposed constitution.
Speaking about projecting into the future, one of the things that your work does very well is to talk about the founding, not just ending in a specific date when the Constitution is ratified, but that the founding continues on into the early 19th century as people start to think about these documents and relate to the documents, and the actions of the first several presidents and the first several Congresses are very important. And Muslims come to play in this era as well, most famously with Jefferson having to deal with the pirates. And how does that play out in terms of shaping what we become known as the United States?
Yeah, this is a great point. So almost everything Americans know about Islam comes from usually plays, one written by Voltaire, a couple others written, that just paint Muhammad and Islam as horribly ignorant and tyrannical and such. But the other way in which they had contact with real Muslims is you had these pirates in North Africa, in Tripoli and Algeria and such. And they really weren't that much of a problem when we were part of the British Empire, because you have this wonderful British Navy that keeps them at bay. But of course, as you can imagine, once we broke from Great Britain, Great Britain said, hey, you're on your own now. But American merchants want to trade in the Mediterranean, so they take a chance and they sail in there, and sometimes they sail out unscratched. But then sometimes these pirates, which were really quite good sailors and warriors, would capture American ships and bring them into Tripoli or Algeria or a few other city-states, and hold the they would actually make these Caucasian American sailors slaves, right? And so this is just reinforcing this horrible narrative that Islam is this tyrannical, horrible faith. Occasionally these slaves would then be ransomed or escape, and then they would write these narratives of their time spent under Islamic slavery, which, as you might imagine, didn't paint Islam in a particularly good light. And so this was a problem, and it was a problem for Adams. It was later a problem for Jefferson, a problem for Washington, I guess. It was sort of interesting. John Adams, he pretty much said, look, we can't afford to fight these guys, so let's pay them off. Let's pay them protection money. Jefferson, on the other hand, was much more aggressive, and eventually, as we know from the song, sent the Marines into Tripoli and wiped out the pirates, at least for the time being.
Speaking of Tripoli, I've heard that the Treaty of Tripoli, often used as evidence that America was not founded as a Christian nation. Could you go into that controversy a little bit?
Yeah, so the Treaty of Tripoli is a very important piece of evidence if one wants to argue that America was not founded as a Christian nation. And that's a different debate that we might go into. What exactly would that mean? What would it look like for America to be founded as a Christian nation? But the Treaty of Tripoli, if you do want to make this argument that it wasn't founded as a Christian nation, is just very nice, because John Adams, the appeaser, right, he's trying to make peace with these Muslim pirates. And so in the Treaty of Tripoli, which was which became law under his administration, he negotiated a deal with them that we would give them so much money and so many yards of rope and even a couple of ships and all sorts of stuff in exchange for them leaving our shipping alone. And as part of that treaty, there's a famous line in it saying basically that America is in no sense founded on the Christian faith. There's nothing inherent in America that would lead us to be in conflict with our Muslim friends in North Africa, and so therefore we can be at peace. And so this line, this one particular line, the America is in no sense founded as a Christian nation, that this would be negotiated under the Adams administration, technically by a fellow named Joel Barlow, who was out there negotiating on our behalf. This treaty comes back to John Adams, just like today, the treaty sent to the U.S. Senate, and the Senate ratifies this unanimously. And so this gives lots of evidence. It's just not some private side deal, but the entire U.S. Senate ratifies it. And so there you have it, right? You got the President and the Senate saying America is not founded as a Christian nation. So you can imagine why folks who want to make the argument that America was not founded as a Christian nation really, really like this document. I suppose what I would say in response, and I don't really want to dive into that debate right now, but I would say a couple of things. First of all, when you take the context of the time into account, we're just trying to make a deal with these pirates. They leave us alone. And I think that these provisions would be viewed not as some broad statement of principle, but as saying to the pirates, hey, you know, there's no reason for us to be in conflict, certainly no religious reason for us to be in conflict. I think if anyone in America in this era took this as a statement of principle, there would have been a firestorm. There would have been, you know, people would have been objecting, certainly wouldn't have been unanimously ratified in the U.S. Senate. So I just don't think you can read it as some great statement of principle. And then it's also important to note that we have a variety of other treaties after the Treaty of Tripoli, treaties with these pirates, and this clause just falls out altogether. So there's another, I'm not sure exactly how many, but let's say six or eight treaties that don't contain this clause. And so it's simply, I think it's simply ahistorical to take this as some great normative statement.
So what you're saying is that foreign diplomats oftentimes say things that they might not necessarily mean in order to get some diplomacy moving along.
Yeah, you know, a great example is the sort of thing that George W. Bush said after 9/11, right? He went out of his way to praise the virtue of Islam as a religion of peace and so forth. And one suspects he might not actually have believed that, or at least not believed it thoroughly, but it's the sort of thing one would expect and want the president to say in that sort of context. So the context becomes critically important for understanding statements of this nature.
Well, speaking of being founded as a Christian nation, I want to move to our next religious minority here, and this might be a little bit of a surprising one. It is often asserted that although it was not a dominant theological position among the general populace, deism, this kind of vague non-denominational form of Christianity, did happen to be dominant among the educated elite, particularly those involved in the writing of our initial documents. This is, you know, we hear this a lot in relation to Jefferson specifically. You have a chapter written by Darren Staloff. First off, how does he define deism? It doesn't seem like that was a denomination at the time that you could easily identify. So what is deism?
It is clearly not a denomination, and it's a term that's notoriously difficult to define. There's no standard definition accepted by everyone. But the definition he uses is a pretty common definition, the definition that most people, at least most people who say they've been to college, would probably come to if you set them down and force them to define it. Basically, the idea of a deist, deists believe that there is a creator God. Okay, there is something approximating the Judeo-Christian God out there who created the world. This God wants us to be good and not bad, and so there's still this notion of morality that it's, you know, that it's good, you know, that it's bad to murder people and so forth. This God does not intervene in human affairs, and this is a critically important thing. The image that oftentimes comes to mind is clockmaker God, right? The clockmaker makes a clock and then steps away from it. It runs on its own. And so within this environment, humans have free will. They have their own agency. They should live morally. But ultimately, it's kind of just what we're doing. God isn't intervening. He's not doing miracles. He's not giving revelation to particular individuals. With respect to the Bible, there's a bit of, or other sacred texts, there's a bit of difference between or among the deists. But generally, they would say that the Bible, you know, might have some good moral ideas, but there certainly is a lot of stuff in there that a reasonable person wouldn't accept. And so reason becomes very, very important for the deist, and there certainly isn't a deference to the Bible that you would find among traditional Protestants or Catholics.
Yeah, it's often asserted that Jefferson had his own commentary on the Bible, you know, Jefferson being touted as one of the main deists, and we can talk about whether or not that was actually the case, but I mean, he brought his own interpretation of the Bible that was probably different than Congregationalists at the time.
Yeah, Jefferson clearly rejected Orthodox Christianity, and he clearly rejected an Orthodox understanding of the Bible, so famously, at two different points, he sat down, he took out his scissors, and he cut out the portions of the Bible that he believed to be true, the ones he liked, and he pasted them together in what is oftentimes called the Jefferson Bible. And again, there's two versions of this. And in effect, what he liked is he really liked Jesus' moral teaching. He thought Jesus had a lot of good things to say about loving your neighbor and being good and this sort of thing. But anything that smacked of a miracle, or virtually everything, certainly the incarnation, the Trinity, the atonement, the virgin birth, all these things are thrown out the window because a rational person simply can't believe that a virgin can give birth, right? And so all these things are thrown out. And this is this would not be uncommon for deists to do this sort of thing, but let me quickly jump to say something. It is, in fact, as you suggested, very common to say most of the founders, many of the founders were deists. But if being a deist includes the idea that God does not intervene in human affairs, Jefferson is clearly on record several times saying that God does, in fact, intervene in the affairs of men and nations. Now, it's possible that in these instances he's just engaging in political rhetoric. I'm very open to that. But I just want to throw that out, that it might even be the case that even though Jefferson isn't an Orthodox Christian, that it might be inaccurate to label him as a deist. And in fact, for virtually every founder you could think of, any of the most liberal founders, from a theological perspective, a Franklin, a Hamilton, a Madison, an Adams, all these guys are on record as saying God intervenes in human affairs. Someone like George Washington, who's usually thrown in this list, he says this over like 50 times. He's always talking about providence.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does become a real interesting question. The way I'll phrase it is, were any of the civic leaders in the American founding deists? And I want to suggest that the answer might be yes, probably one or two. Ethan Allen, and if we count him as an American, Thomas Paine. But even Paine, in a couple of occasions, talks about God intervening in human affairs, but in his case, I'm really quite sure that it's simply a rhetorical flourish.
Yeah, what about Tom Paine? He's an interesting character. He's probably the most radical of all the founders, and he eventually jumped very enthusiastically into supporting the French Revolution. And I mean, if there's a candidate for being a deist and possibly an outright anti-clerical person, I mean, it would be Tom Paine. What were his religious views, and did they hold sway at the time?
Yeah, he comes from a very interesting background, right? He's born into a very poor family in England. We need to keep this in mind. He's not born in America. One of his parents is a Quaker, one is a Anglican. I forget exactly how that falls out. But he comes from this hodgepodge, this mixed hodgepodge. He later was influenced a bit by the Methodists. And then he does, in fact, drinks deeply from the wells of the Radical Enlightenment. So he comes over to America, and he plays a critical role. I mean, he is a penman. He is a great author. You know, Common Sense, The American Crisis. These are some of the best reads out of the American founding. One thing that's really interesting, if you read something like Common Sense, he uses scripture all over the place. He uses scriptural arguments. So regardless of what he personally believed, he knew that these arguments would be very persuasive in the American founding. Okay, so he was... so let me take a step back. So Common Sense is just full of scriptural references. He might not have actually believed that the Bible was God's inspired word, but he recognized that biblical rhetoric could be very persuasive in the American founding, and so he used it quite a bit. So after helping out in America, and he really was critical, I don't want to take anything away from his accomplishment. As you suggest, he goes back to Europe, he goes to France particularly, and he makes a lot of trouble. Collectively, he does come back to America eventually, but collectively, and this is pretty important, he spends only 22 years of his 77 years in America. And that's why I suggest we really want to question, should we count this guy as an American founder? He's born in England, raised in England, and spends only about 22 of his 77 years in America. Now, what's important is when he goes back to Europe, now his deism or heterodoxy really comes out. He writes The Age of Reason, which is a full-throated attack on the Bible, on Orthodox Christianity. And again, he is somewhat of a deist. He believes in a God and that there's right and wrong, but ultimately he rejects traditional Orthodox Christianity. When he comes back to America, and this is what's very telling, no one wants to have anything to do with him. And in fact, a number of the founders wrote repudiation of the Age of Reason. Thomas Jefferson was basically his only friend, and Thomas Jefferson took him into his house and this sort of thing. And so I think that just goes to highlight how very unpopular heterodox people in general, or deists in general, were in the American founder. There were certainly some people like Jefferson and John Adams and Ben Franklin who clearly rejected Orthodox Christianity. But let me tell you, Tony, they were very, very careful to keep their views private. The only way we know of these views, basically, is by their private correspondence that they would oftentimes, Thomas Jefferson would famously, write private over the beginning of these letters. Some of these letters that he wrote, he actually ended up not sending because he recognized it would be so politically damaging if his true political views came out that he just kept them very, very private.
And that is one of the interesting things that I found about your work is that you talk about what I would call the background radiation of Christianity and the culture at the time. And it's actually a pretty strong background radiation. So maybe even the term background is not quite appropriate. And nonetheless, a lot of scholars pluck different phrases or sentences or paragraphs from these private writings. But as you make note, that these are private writings, that they're dealing with a culture, a religious culture in America at the time that was not indicative of their private writings.
No, that's exactly right. Let me, you're a good social scientist, a better social scientist than I am. Let me just throw a few quick statistics at you. So if you think about this very short list of five or six founders that scholars tend to look at, Washington, Jefferson, Adams, Madison, Hamilton, Franklin, of this list of six, five of them either were or eventually became Anglicans. All right? Only one of them remains a Congregationalist throughout his life, and that's John Adams, but as I've already conceded, he became a very bad example of a Calvinist. So five of the six are Anglican. In America at the time, only about 15% of Americans are Anglican. Something like 50 to 75% are Reformed Christians or Calvinists. And so what we're doing, what historians and other social scientists are doing, is they're plucking out these five or six very important people, to be sure, but they really don't represent America very well in terms of a religious demographic, and as well, they're unrepresentative in other respects. So, Tom Paine and Alexander Hamilton are from other places, right?
Mm-hmm.
Franklin and Jefferson and Adams all spent significant time in Europe. This is not what most Americans did. Ben Franklin spent over half of the last 35 years of his life over in Europe. What I want to suggest is a small group of elites, very important to be sure, but very, very unrepresentative of the American founders. And so when you expand the conversation to other important people, and other people even who admittedly aren't quite as important but still played very important roles in crafting the Declaration of Independence and fighting the war for independence and crafting the state constitution, writing the U.S. Constitution, ratifying the U.S. Constitution, when you look at this broader constellation of folks, you see a very, very different picture, and that's why we've edited these various books to try to shine light on really what the bigger picture looks like. And when you do this, you see that, in fact, Protestant Christianity is very, very important. Something like 97% of Americans of this era, of European descent, so not counting the Native Americans, not counting the slaves or African Americans in general, 97% are Protestant. About 3% are Catholic, and then you have about 2,000 Jews out there. So it's a very, very Protestant environment. And so Protestant views, like the importance of the Bible, are paramount. You can't understand the American founding if you don't understand that.
Now, you mentioned the Bible here, and your frequent collaborator, Dan Dreisbeck, has a chapter in this book on the Bible and the founding. And I want to hold denominational labels aside right now, including that of deism, and look at the intellectual bookshelf of the founders. And I think Dan Dreisbeck does this very well. You know, books and pamphlets, they were becoming a lot more plentiful as compared to previous centuries, at this time. It wasn't anything like today, but, you know, books are out there. There are some books that are there. And there were probably a handful of books that were shared reading by a lot of the founders. And, you know, a lot of us think about the works of, John Locke or maybe Thomas Hobbes to throw in there. But one of the most commonly printed and read books of all time, and including at that era, was the Bible. Did the Bible play any role in framing the debates around that time? Did the political elites hearken back to it when they discussed how to build a new nation? I mean, we've got some indication of that, but what's Dreisbeck saying?
Well, this is one of the most interesting chapters in the book, and I have to say he's Daniel's working on a book manuscript that should be published within a year or two by Oxford University Press on this question. First of all, you need to recognize, as I think you know, that a lot of scholars, very prominent scholars, Wilson Carey McWilliams, John Fia, Mark Knoll even, are clearly on record, Ed Morgan, the great historian, as saying, well, the American founders really didn't use the Bible, they didn't look to the Bible for guidance. I'll give you a quote here. Wilson Carey McWilliams says that the founding generation rejected or de-emphasized the Bible and biblical rhetoric. And there's another half dozen quotes like that. Ed Morgan writes that there's no evidence that Washington used or even read his Bible. Right? You know, some pretty powerful claims. And instead, of course, what are they reading? What are the American founders reading if they aren't reading the Bible? They're reading the works of the Enlightenment, particularly John Locke, and that's what's forming their political convictions. Dreisbeck does an excellent job of showing that this is just simply false. And of course, things are messy and you want to sort it out, but I'm just going to simply make a powerful statement here. The Bible was by far and away the most influential book in almost every respect in the American founding. Donald Lutz, a very good political scientist, helps us demonstrate this with a great article he did, about maybe 20, 30 years ago, where he went through a ton of political literature, and he counted up citations. Who are these guys citing in their political writings? And what you see is the Bible is cited far more than the works, all Enlightenment works combined. So take all the works of the Enlightenment by Locke and Montesquieu and Voltaire and a bunch of others, put them all together and compare them to the Bible, and the Bible is cited a lot more. And Lutz actually far undercounts the influence of the Bible, because one of the things he does is he doesn't count, he doesn't look at sermons, if those sermons don't also cite secular authors, like a John Locke, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so if you were to include those sorts of sermons in your pool, you would have far more references to the Bible. And then this is what is critically important. The American founders could count on their fellow Americans knowing the Bible. And so they would seldom actually cite, how we might cite a Bible verse and then put in Micah 4:4, Micah 6:8, something like that. They didn't do that. They just simply used the verse. So Micah 4:4, as it turns out, is George Washington's favorite verse. He uses this over 50 times in his writings, in his letter to the Hebrew congregation and elsewhere. He's just using it all the time, but he never uses the citation. And so someone like Ed Morgan can read through Washington's writings, and since he's not seeing citations to biblical text, and apparently isn't as familiar with the Bible as he should be, he then can come to the conclusion that Washington isn't citing the Bible, whereas in fact if one is fairly knowledgeable about Scripture, you see it's all over the place. Yeah, so there's no question that that these folks are using the Bible in their political rhetoric, and I think you can make a good argument they're using the Bible as a guide for public policy, and certainly the Bible's informing their basic political ideas at a theoretical level.
you know, I can imagine the norms of scholarly citation were not as strict as they were back then, and the, you know, rules on plagiarism probably weren't in play. So,
no, not at all.
Yeah, you had to do that. With the time remaining that we have, I want to just briefly cover a few of the other chapters you have in here, and I, you know, will turn our listeners back to the book Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. You can link to it at our website. You have another set of religious minorities that are at play here. You got the Quakers, you got the Baptists, and also an interesting chapter on just John Hancock. Give us some flavor for this. Let's, you know, maybe perhaps talk a little bit about the Quakers. I think most people are familiar with the Quakers. They're a religious minority in Pennsylvania. They tend to be very concentrated, and most people associate them with oatmeal. But what role did the Quakers play?
Yeah, Quakers are great. I'm glad you asked me about that, because I teach at a Quaker school at George Fox University. George Fox is the founder of the Quakers. This was founded in the hurly-burly of the English Civil War. The Quakers basically are Protestants on steroids. So, for instance, Roman Catholics had 7 sacraments. Protestants came along in the Reformation and threw out 5 of them. And the Quakers said, well, why do we even need 2? And so they threw out the 2 sacraments that most Protestants accept. They also embraced a variety of other ideas. The idea that, you know, the Bible is real important, but also we need to be listening to the Holy Spirit within us. And you know how Protestants rejected this sort of sacerdotalism between the laity and the clerics, whereby the clerics were necessary to be intermediaries between regular people and God. The Protestants came along with this notion of priesthood of all believers, that we're all equal in very important respects. And the Quakers said, yeah, that's right. And even we're so equal that in our churches, in our meetings, we aren't going to have a minister. So most Protestants, Presbyterian, Congregationalists, and Anglicans, they would still have their minister, right, who would preach and this sort of thing. But the Quakers said, look, what we're going to do is just come together in these meetings, and we'll just sit there and wait for the Spirit to move. And we don't know who the Spirit's going to move, so it might not be the same person every time. One day it may be John, next day it may be Frank, and what's really kind of interesting is they said the next week it might be Sally. And so you had women speaking in these Quaker religious services. The Quakers became real leaders in the fight for gender equality. In the 18th century, they became among the key leaders in the fight for abolition, applying this notion of equality across the board to blacks and Native Americans and women, a real important advocate for equality in America. They're also famously known as pacifists. They take Jesus' teaching and the Sermon on the Mount really quite literally. And this led them, I think, to respond in different ways to the abuses they did see that their fellow Protestants saw coming from Great Britain, say, with the Stamp Act crisis. But they responded to it, as Jane Calvert shows in her excellent chapter on John Dickinson and the Quakers, in a very different way than some of these other Protestants, such as Sam Adams over in Boston.
Yeah, it seems that there's an interesting setup here with the Quakers. They got this radical egalitarianism, which is infused throughout American history, you know, the popular classes, the everyday person against the monarchy. And yet, when it comes to breaking off with Britain, you would think that they would. And I know John Dickinson, one of the famous Quaker founders, he refused to sign the Declaration of Independence, right?
It's a complicated story. One of the things that Jane shows is that these folks in Pennsylvania, the Quaker leader, someone like a Dickinson, they were very cognizant of the problems they were seeing. But they said, wait a minute, we need to try nonviolent ways to resist this. So whereas Sam Adams and John Hancock and others are encouraging the mobs to tar and feather people, to intimidate the stamp collectors and so forth, the folks that would collect the revenues from the Stamp Act, the Quakers said, okay, we need to resist this, but we should resist it by peaceful appeals to the king. We should resist it passively. We should, you know, maybe boycotts and things of this nature. And so John Dickinson becomes a critical player here. Now, Jane would point out, she does point out, that John Dickinson is born into a Quaker family, but he never technically joins a Quaker meeting. And so one could claim, and she claims that it's probably inaccurate to refer to him as a Quaker, but she goes on to say, he seems to have been influenced by Quaker ideas. So, for instance, he is intimately involved in all the important American really political events and contests from 1764 through the writing of the Constitution. He served in the Continental and Confederation Congresses. He's at the Constitutional Convention. And he becomes known as the Penman of the Revolution. His letters from the Pennsylvania farmer, some of the most important revolutionary propaganda we have, arguing that the British are out of line, that Parliament can't do the sorts of things they're doing. But when push comes to shove, interestingly enough, he keeps saying, look, we need to speak up for our rights, but we should be real hesitant to pick up arms. And so eventually, when push came to shove, he refused to sign the Declaration of Independence, which is probably one of the reasons we don't know as much about him. If you think about the famous founders, they tended to be on the winning side of history, and so anti-federalists and those that didn't support the war for independence, at least initially, are less well-regarded, less well-known. Dickinson does, in fact, eventually come to support the war. In fact, unlike many of the founders, he actually enlisted in the army, enlisted as a private, and fought in the war, and then later plays important roles in American politics. He was simultaneously, this is a nice piece of trivia, he was simultaneously for a couple of months the governor of Delaware and the governor of Pennsylvania. He kind of lived right on the border there and was well regarded by both of these colonies in the state. So Dickinson's one of these founders like Roger Sherman, even if, for the sake of argument, we want to look at the more important founders, Dickinson clearly should be in this list, along with Sherman and Henry and John Jay and a number of other folks.
Wow. So, I mean, people talking and complaining about Scott Brown or Hillary Clinton moving between states to get elected to some places, they should look at Dickinson and say, hey, he was governor in two states at the same time. Wow.
there is a precedent, absolutely.
Dickinson didn't sign the Declaration of Independence, but there is one guy who did and wanted to make a big flourish about it, and that's John Hancock. You know, we all associate large, flamboyant signatures with John Hancock. You have a chapter on him, and just briefly tell us why John Hancock writes in a book on faith and the founders of the American Republic.
Yeah, sure. Well, this book is really divided into two sections. The first one has almost solely thematic chapters, Jews and the Founding, Islam and the Founding, the Bible and the Founding. The second section, what we do is we use individual founders to shine light on a broader tradition. So Jane Calvert's chapter, for instance, is on John Dickinson and the Quaker influence on the American founding. John Hancock is he has a big flamboyant signature, and he's a big flamboyant person, a very rich merchant, oftentimes accused of being a smuggler. But one of the things Gary Scott Smith shows, Gary Scott Smith at Grove City College, who I believe has been on your podcast.
He has.
He shows that he actually is a pretty good representative of these Congregational Americans, these Calvinist Americans, that even though he did live a very flamboyant, luxurious lifestyle, he actually gave a ton of money away. He was very generous with the resources that God gave to him, and he was influenced by Reformed political thought to resist the what he perceived as a move towards tyranny on the part of Parliament and the King. And so he was, in spite of some elements of his life that one might say, raised some questions. Was he a smuggler? Gary Scott Smith looked at the question and says, well, it's really hard to answer accurately. Some people just blatantly assert, yes, he was a smuggler. But that depends a lot on what sort of evidence you look at. Oftentimes the people who assert this strongly rely as evidence upon charges brought by the British. But of course the British perhaps had a bit of a bias here. And also questions of what exactly counts as smuggling in this era. So he does represent, in many respects, Congregationalist political thought in this era.
Now, we talked about the Quakers who are affiliated with your university, George Fox University, and I love that tagline you have, Protestantism on steroids. Is that a tagline at John Fox or George Fox?
No, I made that up myself.
Oh, that's good. You should put that before the president of the university said, hey, let's put a big banner up there. Come to George Fox University, Protestantism on steroids. That'd be kind of cool. But
yeah.
One other chapter that you have in there relates to Baptists And since this program is sponsored by Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, I think we would not do any justice to your book if we don't mention the Baptist role here. And that's a very interesting one, because the Baptists are a denomination that are just starting to historically get rolling in America around this period of time. And so one could definitely see them as a, you know, religious minority that might not have very much influence in the founding. So what was their role?
Yeah, it's a great question. To make a nice tie as well, I should say that the author of this, Joe Coker, is in the Department of Religion at Baylor University.
Sick'em Bears.
Yeah. So the so what we had him do is we had him look at two of the most important Baptists in the era, John Leland and Isaac Backus, two important Baptist ministers, leaders. Now, as you suggested, the Baptists were a fairly small number, and Joe gives a rundown of this, and I don't have it in my head, but if you go to, say, 1770, there aren't all that many Baptists in America, but they're growing by leaps and bounds, so they're already more numerous by the time we get to the 1780s, and by the time we get to the pretty early 19th century, they're one of America's largest denominations, so they're growing by leaps and bounds. The Baptists are dissenters. They dissent from the dominant Protestant denominations, Anglican or Presbyterian or Congregationalist. And so they oftentimes run afoul of the established churches within these various states. And so probably their most notable contribution is they were great advocates of religious liberty, both in their writing, in their actions, and in their refusal to accept any sort of second-class treatment. So generally, what would happen, you know, we think about established churches and we might have these visions of tyranny arise. Generally, it wasn't there wasn't tyranny. There wasn't real horrible persecution. Now, there were in a few instances some Baptists got thrown in jail and were pretty ill-treated in Virginia. But generally, what would happen? Generally, the complaint the Baptists had is that they would be tolerated, but they would have to pay taxes to support the Anglican Church, and then if you had a Baptist minister, they would have to take up offerings to support that person. Eventually, after the War for Independence, even in places like New England, and states like Connecticut and Massachusetts start saying, okay, you know what, we'll even let your tax dollars go towards your own minister if you only get this certificate from the state. But they said, wait a minute, why should we have to get this certificate? This isn't even fair. And so they continued to fight for pure religious equality.
I hear some of them even brought that issue up with Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, well, at least famously, there's a great, a famous reported meeting between John Leland and James Madison in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
Whereby Leland basically made a deal that he would support Madison, if he would make sure there was a Bill of Rights added. And the Bill of Rights, of course, the most important thing he cared about was an assertion of a provision to protect religious liberty.
Yeah, I was thinking about those old Danbury Baptists that wrote Thomas Jefferson.
Right. Yeah, that's famous. So the Baptists were about the only supporters to Thomas Jefferson in New England. And so after he was elected, they wrote him a letter congratulating him, and Jefferson wrote his famous letter to the Danbury Baptists in about 1802, I think it is, where he famously says that America, that the Establishment Clause creates a wall of separation between church and state. But here's an interesting twist, and Joe shows shines some light on this. The Baptists definitely liked religious liberty. There's no question about that. Oftentimes, contemporary separationists, people who want a very strict separation of church and state, say the Baptists were strict separationists as well. And the story here becomes very complicated, because someone like an Isaac Backus is a bit more conservative in this respect. He isn't as bothered by things like presidents or governors issuing calls for prayer and fasting. He might not even oppose certain sorts of state funds going to religious schools, as long as it was non-discriminatory. John Leland was a bit more of a separationist. But this is one of my favorite stories about the letters to the Danbury Baptists, which Daniel Dreisbach tells very well in his book on this subject. The day after Jefferson penned this letter, the final version of the letter, to the Danbury Baptists, remember, Jefferson is saying the Establishment Clause creates a wall of separation between church and state. Jefferson goes to the U.S. Capitol building on Sunday morning where there are church services. And who does he hear preach but John Leland, this great Baptist itinerant minister and this opponent of establishment. And so John Leland, as much as he advocated for religious liberty, as much as he didn't like establishment, he apparently didn't see any problem with having church services in the U.S. Capitol building, and of course he participated in them by preaching that morning. So I think Joe Coker's chapter really helps complicate what is oftentimes a very simplistic story about the views of Baptists in this era.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about this, and it's a fascinating book. We haven't covered all the chapters. You've had other folks like Don Drakeman and Greg Fraser and Robert Calhoun and Ruma Chopra are all included in here with a lot of different variants on religion and the founding from angles that one would never ever think of. We'll probably have to talk to you again next year. You're our July 4th go-to guy. But here's what I'm wondering. I mean, this book is incredibly comprehensive. You've written 9 others in addition to this. You must have everything covered about religion in the late 18th and early 19th century. What's next for Mark David Hall?
Well, first of all, I think there's a lot of good work to be done in this era. So much of the work has just gone over and over and over again, these 5 or 6 famous founders, that if one really believes the conversation should be expanded, there's plenty of real interesting people and people who played important roles in crafting key documents that should be looked at, and other questions that might be considered. And so I suspect I'll keep working on that. Well, right now I must say I'm very excited about a project I'm doing with Daryl Charles, where we're editing a volume that will look at each of America's major wars and evaluate them from a just war perspective. Was the war just? Should America have entered this war? And then when we are fighting this war, do we fight it in a just fashion? So some work has been done on this. Ronald Wells has a pretty good book on it. But I think ours will be a real contribution to literature. We've got some great scholars lined up, scholars that really understand and embrace just war theory, but who are also willing to do the hard historical work of diving down into some of these complicated conflicts like World War I and trying to evaluate them from a normative perspective.
Well, that is something that is out there on the horizon and we'll be watching for, and might be even some good fodder for next July 4th. So we'll have to, you know, invite people to stick around for another year, because they're going to hear Mark David Hall, because as usual, you've been absolutely brilliant and it's been an honor to get to interview again. I have to admit, these interviews are the highlight of my year. You know, I look forward to the fireworks and my discussions with Mark David Hall. So, Mark, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Hey, thank you for having me, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.